You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 2nd, 2021, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Tara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella. And Evan Bernstein.
I left my weapons at home, everyone. How are you?
Yeah, but aren't you at home, Evan?
Oh, yeah, actually. Yeah. Shut up.
You left them in the other room.
Yes. Out of arm's reach.
So we're almost halfway through the year. June. Whenever June hits, you always think, damn, the year's almost half over already.
It's a vicious reminder of how fast time goes and how precious our time on this planet is.
It makes me happy, Steve, because we're that much closer to Halloween.
Yeah.
Well, that's one way of looking at it.
November 1st, though, I want to cry.
So we're going to do a COVID update this week. We haven't been doing one for a while because there's a lot of news recently about the lab leak theory for where COVID came from.
Yes.
And you know, we've talked about it a couple of times on the show. We're getting a lot of emails about it. It's definitely now being taken very seriously in the media. You might wonder that there's been like some new information that has altered the evaluation of whether or not, you know, what the origin of COVID-19 is, of the SARS-CoV-2.
That never happens in science.
But the fact is, there really isn't any new information. That's the thing, Evan. It's not,
yeah.
There really isn't. So at least scientifically speaking. So if you recall, in the early days of the pandemic in 2020, when there was a lot of speculation about where SARS-CoV-2 came from, and at the time, the prevailing hypothesis, only because it's the simplest one, is that it's a zoonotic infection, that it sort of crossed over from an animal reservoir to the human population. It's a virus that does that. It's, you know, bouncing around Asia, mainly in the bat population, other animals as well. They don't really know exactly what the path was, but that's like the go-to explanation. But the alternate hypothesis was that, well, there's the Wuhan Virology Lab, and they're studying coronaviruses. Maybe it came from that lab. And by the way, that hypothesis that a virus came from a lab, either deliberately or accidentally, crops up with every viral infection epidemic.
It always has to be.
Yeah, so that's
part of the
yeah, part of the course.
Choices.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So early on, scientists took a look at that. They're trying to figure out. And so there's really two ways you can kind of get at this question. One is to look at the virus itself for telltale
signs.
Like
the DNA of the virus.
Yeah, look at the DNA of the virus, or is it an RNA virus? I forget. Whatever.
Right. Look at the genetic material in the virus.
Look at the genetic material and say, does it have any telltale signatures of genetic manipulation, the kind of thing that would happen in a lab? The other way is to investigate the circumstances around the occurrence of the virus. So let's take the scientific question first. Scientists looked at it. They analyzed it for any signs of laboratory manipulation, and they didn't find any. They said, this does not look like a virus that was cooked up in a lab, right? So for that reason, the zoonotic crossover hypothesis is more likely. And that's, from a scientific point of view, that was pretty much it. There really wasn't any other information to go on.
Right, because it was an out of the blue, like, is it possible that this happened? Maybe it's possible, but there's not really any evidence pointing to it happening.
Yeah, you can't rule it out, but it's unlikely because of the lack of positive evidence for genetic manipulation. This is still the case, by the way. This has not changed. Now, if you take the other approach of investigating the circumstances of the origin of the virus, so early on, China's definitely being cagey about it because, you know, they're an authoritarian government and they're going to be cagey about whatever happened. Even whether it came from their markets or was accidentally leaked or whatever happened, they're not going to want to take the blame for it. And of course, you know, calling it the China virus and all that didn't help. So it kind of became a political issue as far as that's concerned. But still, there was no evidence that is convincing that it was lab leaked. And again, and we could divide the lab leak theory into three different possibilities. One is it was deliberately created and released. That's like the real conspiracy theory.
Yeah, and that's the one that always pops up.
Yeah, but you know, again, there's the idea is like China's going to hurt you know, democracy or capitalism by right. releasing the virus. But, you know, that's kind of a, it is kind of a grand conspiracy theory. Right. The second one is that it's an engineered virus that was accidentally released. And mm-hmm. the third one is that it's not an engineered virus. It's a natural virus that they were just studying in Wuhan and got accidentally released. Right. So there's
right. Like the concerns about smallpox or anthrax. Yeah. We have to keep them in labs so that we can study them. We got to keep them really safe.
That's kind of what the quote unquote lab leak theory has migrated to because of the lack of evidence of genetic engineering. You're kind of left with, okay, it was a naturally occurring virus, but they still were studying it and accidentally released it. But in any case, and that's the hardest one to disprove, right? Because you can't really disprove it by examining the virus. You have to be entirely use the investigation method.
Right, because we know that they were studying coronaviruses sure, absolutely. In that Wuhan lab.
It's not crazy. It's not impossible. It's totally possible that it was an accidental leak of a non-modified virus that was just being studied there and China covered it up. Sure, I would buy that, but there's got to be evidence for it. But we got to separate that from the it was modified or specific deliberately engineered because there's no scientific evidence for that looking at the virus. Okay, so the World Health Organization, this is earlier this year, completed their examination looking at both the virus and the circumstances of its release. We talked about this a couple months ago. They concluded the far and away the most likely scenario is zoonotic crossover. And then, like, really, really unlikely was a lab leak. They just could not find any evidence to support that. However, they did caveat that a little bit by saying that, you know, China's cooperative-ish, you know, but they didn't give us the completely unfettered access that we would have preferred. But, you know, as authoritarian regimes go, they were okay. You know, that's kind of, you know, summarizing their impression there. So still, we're left with no real evidence of the lab leak hypothesis, any version of it, and the WHO thinks it's extremely unlikely. Now the lab leak theory is sort of rearing its head again, and again, not because of any new scientific data, although there have been studies published in the last year claiming to show evidence that the virus was engineered. But I'm just going to give you the quick summary. These are all, pun intended, batshit crazy, horrible science studies. These were like,
and they all got published.
Yeah, they were destroyed. I mean, they were absolutely destroyed in when reviewed by other virologists. Some of them were published in like inappropriate journals because they were rejected by all the virology right. journals. I mean,
the
they're
usual
like
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you want to get into all the technical details, then what I refer you to a science-based medicine article by David Gorski published on May 31st, again on science-based medicine, where he goes into excruciating detail about why any of those studies published claiming that there is genetic evidence in the virus itself of engineering. There isn't, is the short answer. None of it is convincing. None of it convinced the scientific community. And when you look at the details, it's horrible, like really horrible science. Okay, so that's where that is. Again, you can't prove it wasn't a leaked unmodified virus. Can't even completely prove it wasn't modified in some way, but there's just no evidence to support that when looking at the virus. A couple of things have cropped up that basically amount to circumstantial evidence. You know, one is that several of the virologists working at Wuhan were sick in November. We don't know what they were sick with. We don't know if it was with a COVID-like illness. It could easily have been the flu. We just don't know. So that's...
But we do know that it was a season when people get sick.
Yeah. Yeah, but so that's circumstantial evidence at best.
It's but aren't you leaving out an important detail that not only were they sick, but all three went to the hospital?
Yeah, but to clarify further, the reports just say that they sought care at the hospital. They weren't admitted to the hospital. And they said their symptoms were consistent with either COVID or a seasonal illness. So that's all we know.
Right. So they went to the hospital, but we don't know even... it was described as flu-like symptoms, right? It wasn't even described as pneumonia, which we know that in the early days of COVID-19 cropping up, it was a pneumonia of like unknown origin. That's how it was mostly documented. Doctors started to see a pattern in pneumonia symptoms among patients.
But you could argue we don't know all the details,
Right. Right. That's true. Clearly, that's kind of a theme here.
Should it have been disclosed or discovered earlier than sort of just recently?
Well, right. It makes it look worse that we're just finding
out
about it.
Yeah, there's no question that the Chinese government's being cagey about all of this, which they're doing to sort of protect themselves, but they're just fueling suspicion. No question. And they're also putting out really terrible propaganda. In fact, one of our listeners, I won't mention their name, but they said, what do you guys think about this? And I'm not even sure what their take on it was, but it was an article in like some socialist newspaper that is calling the lab leak theory a Western conspiracy theory that the United States is using in order to wage war against China. Like, it's just horrible propaganda, total anti-American propaganda. So, and that's coming up, you know, and it's coming from China. So that's how they're claiming that we released it from one of our labs, you know? So yeah, they're saying crazy shit like that. No one's going to take you seriously. No one's going to have faith that you're being transparent. So they're exacerbating the problem from that point of view. And the more they, you know, pull those kind of shenanigans, the more credence they give to any kind of conspiracy theory, because they are hiding things and they are putting out propaganda. You know, and I wonder how much of that is just like a cultural thing where they don't realize how that's going to play in a non-authoritarian, you know, part of the world. It's like, no, you know, it's not going to fly. It's going to make us trust you less. Not like, oh, okay, it's all okay then. You didn't do it. So that's where we are.
Trust has been a major issue from the beginning. Yeah, and totally. Clearly that's been a big problem with like the global response to this virus, is that there's been a lot of finger pointing, a lot of lack of trust, you know, it's,
yeah,
and it bums me out, because it's one of those examples of like, we often want to think, and more often than not, I think that there's good evidence to support the idea that sort of like science diplomacy wins out. And even in this example, the globe caught a virus and now the globe is getting treated for this virus. It's slower in certain areas, we know, and it's incredibly unfortunate. And there are a million geopolitical reasons for that. But science diplomacy ultimately is sort of coming out on top of geopolitical conflict. Mm-hmm. That said, could have happened a lot faster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's supposed to at least work that way. But then when it gets politicized, it kind of gets contaminated to a certain degree.
And to be clear, as I said, it's been politicized on both sides. You know,
sure.
So certainly China is taking a very defensive stance for it, but the Trump administration took a completely anti-China stance. And the other thing is, and a lot of people are pointing this out, just because Trump said it doesn't mean it's wrong. Right. Mm-hmm. People could be right for the wrong reason. And, you know, I wouldn't say that he had a thoughtful reason to try to blame it on China. It was kind of a reactionary thing. It doesn't make it wrong. But having said that, there isn't any evidence to support it. It is at this point just an unsupported conspiracy theory with some circumstantial evidence at best.
Right. The appropriate thing to do for Trump to do would be what Biden is doing now, which is let's set up an inquiry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's learn about it.
No, so totally. I do think this is the kind of thing that the world needs transparency. Absolutely. So saying, let's investigate it without pointing fingers, without making accusations, without invoking conspiracy theories, to say, okay, you know, this is something that some legitimate concerns have been raised. Legitimate concerns, not just your made up concerns. Legitimate concerns. So let's, you know, if the WHO thinks that they needed more transparency, let's do whatever it takes to convince the WHO, convince the world that, you know, they're not hiding anything. And, you know, try to put it to bed as best as we can, you know, as you say, with scientific diplomacy, et cetera. We absolutely need that. And, you know, the thing that we have to convince China is that if they really have nothing to hide, it is in their best interest to be transparent, right? And how else do you expect people to interpret a lack of transparency? You know, they kind of deserve what they get if they're not willing to be, and it just drop the propaganda, because that's not going to play well either. That just makes people think you have something to hide. So there's blame to go around in terms of all the confusion that we have right now, but cutting through it is a scientific question. There's really no reason to think it was leaked from a lab. From an investigation point of view, it's just circumstantial evidence at this point. I wouldn't be shocked if it was an accidental release, for example. That's consistent with all the evidence that we have. Again, but we can't conclude that that's the case. What's disappointing is the way the media has been reporting it, because the media, unfortunately, they just basically pick their narrative and then that's what they go with, you know? And they'll flip the script if that's what the narrative is now, without really digging down to the actual issues. I mean, there's obviously some good reporting out there, but I'm talking about the baseline sort of majority of the media. It's like, oh, now it's suddenly okay. The lab thing theory is a thing. Okay, we'll go with that narrative now. You know, without really putting it into any kind of deep perspective.
If it was supposed, if it was something that was a lab leak that was, say, intentional, then that would just be stupid. Because if you're going to intentionally release it, you wouldn't want to release it in your own country. You would release it in some other country. You know, releasing it in your own country and then covering it up would not be good spycraft.
Yeah, the deliberate release doesn't make any sense. You're not only going to release it in your own country, you're going to release it next to the lab where you made it. You know, that's not how it's done, right? I mean,
hire some lackey mule dude to fly somewhere with a boatload of it in his system.
Yeah, didn't you see 12 monkeys? I mean, you got to spread that shit around, you know? But anyway, that's obviously the least credible.
Right, and wanting to hide it makes sense because, you're incompetent if that happens. Secondly, you're directly responsible for millions of deaths worldwide. So they have lots of motivation to hide this. And based on the research I did, now this is a year old. I mean, I don't know what the thinking is now, but they calculated a period of like about a week where China delayed releasing the information worldwide when they had enough information that they really should have. And if they had done that, nipping it in the bud would have been so powerful at that stage that literally millions of people would have not died.
Most governments across the globe. It's easy to say that about China because that was the nucleation site.
Right.
There are plenty of examples in America where if we had done...
Totally. Yeah, they're the only ones that were slow off the start gate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, but the asymmetry was that they were the first, and by America knew very well what was coming and still didn't take it seriously. So worse on America for handling it so well. You know, they knew it, but it just kills me to think that a week when... they should have released this information. Could have saved so many lives. Oh,
did you guys watch the Diamond Princess documentary on HBO?
No, what was that about?
No.
Oh, highly recommend. So Diamond Princess, of course, was the cruise ship that had, outside of China at the time, the worst outbreak. This was way back when, like, people didn't know where to port it. All these people were stuck on this cruise ship, and people were dropping like flies with COVID, and it was an international. I mean, I think it was a Japanese cruise ship, but it was international, the passengers.
Yeah.
Like, there were a bunch of people from all over the world. Yeah. And it covers a lot about how, you know, there's a lot of, obviously, inequity in who was treated first, who was taken off. It was based on different governments saying, we want our citizens. The crew from the Philippines were really treated poorly, and they were, like, the last to leave the ship, and many of them got sick. But ultimately... there was a claim made, and I have to put it that way, by the documentarians, but there was a claim made at the end that, you know, there were plenty of American citizens on the ship, that this intel of how the virus spread on this ship was made available relatively early in this process, and it was pretty clear that this was a respiratory virus at this point, yet the general public was not, you know, informed of this. Maybe I shouldn't even say the general public wasn't informed of this, but the science didn't move very quickly, even though there was kind of a real world experiment happening in front of us. And I think, again, you know, a lot of different things go wrong. It's really hard to, you don't really want to point fingers, but there were plenty of examples of evidence in front of us that we, I think, for xenophobic reasons having to do with masks, I think for hopeful reasons just having to do with it couldn't possibly get as bad as all that. A lot of people made a lot of missteps with this pandemic. Okay. We just have a short memory.
Well, we can't forget.
We cannot forget, and we have to know that this is not the last time this is going to happen. If anything, it's probably going to, that gap is going to be closed. You know, it's like 1918 to now, we can kind of compare them because of the death tolls and things like that. It's probably not going to be that many years next time.
Yeah, but
there are worse viruses out there.
We've had three in a decade.
Right. But we got in front of those. And that's not to say people didn't die, anyway. but with the other respiratory viruses, with SARS, with MERS, also with swine flu, with bird flu. You know, the system that was in place worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Insofar as, you know, it didn't become a global pandemic.
Kara, do you think that politics really got in the way here?
I think so, but I think that we make a mistake sometimes when we talk about science as if it's some pure thing that exists in a vacuum, and we say, oh, it became politicized. I think politics is always there.
Sure.
We live in a geopolitical community.
Yeah, what doesn't?
Yeah.
What isn't impacted in some degree by politics.
But the term, I think, is used when you mean that, not that there isn't politics and government and collective decision-making involved. It's just that we hope that those decisions are going to prioritize the science and the common goals. And when other political concerns get prioritized, then we say it was politicized, right? When, like, partisan advantage or whatever, it gets prioritized.
Yeah, but I worry sometimes that that's not how everybody defines that term.
Yeah.
And that they literally think there's some like global science.
I know what you're saying. Yeah.
Think tank. Yeah. And that all the politicians go, I'm just going to take a step back and leave it to the lab coats.
Yeah,
you know?
Science, just like, listen to the science. Like, yeah, science doesn't exist in a vacuum. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to some other news items. Carrie, you're actually going to start us off by talking about taking a left turn.
Ooh.
Good segue. You haven't done that in a while.
Yeah, man. It's different.
Wow.
That ooh sound?
Yeah, that was great.
That's funny. So, yeah, there's this kind of cool study that came out all about transportation, and this one is specifically about left turns. So this interesting researcher, he's like a civil engineer from Penn State, wrote a piece in The Conversation kind of arguing, if we want to get rid of dangerous city traffic, why not just get rid of left turns? And so I feel like I should caveat this.
Whoa.
This is for countries that
drive on the right.
Drive on the right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
If you drive on the left, clearly, then you flip it.
We're talking right turns. Yeah. So clearly, unfortunately, you have to do some like switcheroo if you're listening from the UK or from Australia, New Zealand, places like that. So this researcher has published a bunch of studies, and the newest one is really about like an algorithm. So I want to kind of take a step back and talk about why this argument holds weight. So first of all, some statistics here. 40% of all car crashes happen at intersections. Kind of makes sense, right? Intersections are pretty dangerous places because cars are coming from different directions. Usually on a street, cars are going in the same direction, at least when they're, you know, together on the street. And then among these intersection crashes, 61% of them involve a left-hand turn. So that's pretty dominating, right? Because we've got right turns, we've got go straight, we've got U-turns, we've got all these different ways that intersections are engaged, but about 61% of all crashes at intersections involved a left-hand turn. And let's think about why that is. What do you have to do to turn left?
Cross oncoming traffic.
Turn the steering wheel too.
You do have to do that as well. And so you're crossing oncoming traffic and you're doing it in a specific way. There are a lot of different ways that cities deal with left-hand turns. Sometimes they have their own lane. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they have a light. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes this happens at a, you know, four-way stop sign. Sometimes it's unprotected altogether. I will use some anecdotal stuff from Los Angeles where I live, and anybody who has driven in LA is probably feeling my frustration now. LA has very few left turn signals. Very few. It's just not part of the infrastructure here. We do have left turn lanes. And sometimes at those lanes, we have left turn signals. But very often, if you want to turn left, you wait for the light to cycle. And as it's turning yellow, the rule of thumb is that's when all the left-handed turn people just go. And they go into the red. It's just well known that that's
really
how you have to. Yeah, if you ever want to get across an intersection in LA going left, you're never going to get across during the full green because there's always traffic. So you wait until.
How did they do that? I mean, how many cars can actually do that at a time?
Usually like 2 to 4.
Four can go during yellow.
Yeah, usually you just know. And so they're going on the red and the people in the opposing traffic just kind of let them go. And then you start. It's very strange. It's an LA specific thing, but it's one of these unfortunate situations that if there's a green arrow, that's helpful, right? That's probably the safest way.
Yeah, I love green arrows.
Yeah, and this researcher says the same thing. That's the safest way to turn left at an intersection is to have your own green arrow. The problem is it's highly inefficient because when you have a green arrow to go left, your lane is going left. Perhaps the opposing traffic's left turn lane is going left. All the other traffic is stopped and just waiting for you. It's highly inefficient. So a couple cool things that these researchers did. First, they looked at an analysis that UPS published. And you've got to remember, UPS published this themselves. But still, they claim that they, in 2004, they were like, we want to reduce travel time, the amount of gas that we use, and the amount of emissions we're putting off. So we're not going to, or I shouldn't say not going to altogether, but we're going to minimize left-hand turns. We're just going to change our delivery routes so that drivers don't have to turn
left. Yeah, and it makes perfect sense because they just map their route out with a computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's
totally. Of course. Yeah, we have the technology, right?
Does that exist, by the way? Like, I know, like, GPS, it says, do you want to take the quickest route, the shortest route, the route with the least amount of highway? Can you say, right, I want the route with the least amount, the fewest number of left-hand turns?
I don't think so. But the cool thing is, maybe this kind of research will get that as part of the program.
Yeah.
Because if individual people know this, they might be able to take some initiative as opposed to waiting for a sort of like full redesign of a city.
Yeah.
Although that is what this researcher is claiming, is that we should really be thinking about redesigning cities in this way. Mm. So UPS basically, they claim that per year, they were saving, on average per year, 10 million gallons of gas, 20,000 tons of carbon emissions, and they're delivering an additional 350,000 packages.
I totally
by getting rid of left-hand turns.
By just getting rid of left-hand turns. So how does that, you know, then translate to regular people driving on the road, right? Like just needing to go someplace because we're not working at scale the way that UPS is. And that's where sort of some of this research comes in. So these researchers in 2012 published a paper using mathematical models and then followed it up in 2017 using actual traffic simulations. So first kind of proof of concept and then simulation work. That showed that if you just straight up eliminate left-hand turns on average, here's something interesting. What do you think is the biggest downside of not going left? Like, why don't we all just make sure we go right all the time?
Well, sometimes it'll take longer. A longer path, yeah.
Yeah, right. You got to go right when you would have just gone left.
Right.
And so the researchers were like, yeah, we get that. You have to travel longer distance. It's a pain in the ass. Let's say you just want to turn left to like pull into your driveway. Instead, you got to go around three right turns just to get back where you were.
Yeah, that's kind of a deal breaker if I got to do
that. Yeah, kind of a pain, right? But they did these mathematical models in 2012, traffic simulations in 2017. On average, it only adds one additional city block to people's driving distances.
Yeah, but what is math now?
And so then the question really comes down to, is this something where it's an always hard and fast rule? And, you know, the researchers say no. Of course, the more busy the intersection, the more central in a city the intersection is, the more they recommend removing left-hand turns. If you're talking out of a city in a very, like, seldom crossed intersection, left turns probably don't affect traffic at all. But obviously, as traffic ramps up, left turns do cause potential backups. They cause the potential for car crashes and just generally are not very efficient. I've seen in LA, one of the things that that we do in the city is that we have anti-gridlock zones. So from 4 to 7 p.m., it's clear that I'm not an early riser. I'm like, I know the PM one. What is the AM one? Maybe like 7 to 10 AM? I don't know. There are lanes where you can't park because they become driving lanes on major streets. And you cannot make left turns during those hours onto side streets, especially in places where there is no turn lane, that you would just be like basically stopped in traffic to turn left. And so we do see that in many cities, there are efforts to reduce left-hand turn lanes. But this researcher is saying, I know it seems radical. You know, maybe we add turn lanes, maybe we add more lights. What if you just say, let's just not do it and force people to go around? And apparently, based on the modeling, it works. Mm-hmm. It's kind of simple and cheap and easy way to really affect infrastructure without having to build anything new or spend any new money. You probably just got to put up a few signs. Yeah. No left turn.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I definitely will adjust my my route that I'm taking to avoid making a left-hand turn.
Absolutely.
If I have an option.
Yeah, especially if you know you're just going to be sitting there waiting forever.
No, because we have like one busy main road going through town, and like I could be there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes waiting for a left-hand turn. Like, especially if you have like two lanes on either side and it's a busy street. It could, I try to avoid that at all costs.
Yeah, and you see it a lot, like even just something as simple as you're in a parking structure or a parking lot for a grocery store, and the way out goes onto a relatively busy street. You'll often see you can't turn left here, bro. Just go right. Do a U-turn if you need to. Or go around the block, because turning left means everybody in the parking lot is waiting for you.
Yeah.
Turning right's easy. And again, once again, if you drive on the other side of the road, this would apply to right.
Reverse everything we just said. Yeah.
Yeah. It's opposite day.
Yeah. So it's funny that sometimes things like that are counterintuitive, you know, but you can't argue with the maths.
Right. You know? Right.
But you can argue with Bob.
You can.
But Bob can argue with math, and then we can argue with Bob.
All right. Jay. Is this legit? Are they working on a lozenge that will rebuild tooth enamel?
I think it is. I was looking, Steve. I could not find any information that, you know, said that this wasn't true. The university that's studying it is definitely running the study. And, you know, the scientists who are working on this are definitely engaging with outside companies looking for buyers. So let me tell you, let me give everyone what the info is, and you'll immediately realize why I'm interested in this. So anybody who knows me, including you, Kara, you should know by now,
I
love keeping my teeth in perfect shape. I mean, and more information keeps coming out that, you know, having good dental health could be very beneficial to a lot of other health factors in your life.
Your heart, everything.
Exactly. Yeah. You just really don't want to get an infection in your mouth because it's right near your brain. It could get into your cardiovascular system. It's just bad. And your mouth is a vector. So please keep it clean, folks. So when I read the progress in dentistry, I got excited. You know, I'm like, what?
Do you have like a subscription to progress in dentistry?
I know.
Is this like a journal that shows up at your
door? No, Google search. I definitely have keywords on.
I was really hoping you're just some random citizen that subscribes to a lot of dentistry journals.
I love my teeth. Yeah, so it is a also, you know, a side note, you look more healthy when your teeth look healthy. You know, not only are you healthy, but you look more healthy. Think about it. So clinical trials have begun that are testing a lozenge that is supposed to be able to rebuild tooth enamel. This isn't really that novel. It's great, but you know, we know the mechanism. We understand all of the things that we would need to be able to do it. It really is just taking the time and money for people to just figure out exactly how to make it happen. So let's talk right now about how you can lose the enamel that's on your teeth and why is this bad? So first of all, the enamel is the outer coating on your teeth. It's essentially what makes your teeth hard. Enamel keeps things away like bacteria and food and everything from getting into the inner softer parts of your teeth. You want enamel and you want to keep it healthy. And when you get a cavity, that means that the enamel is rotting away because you left food on your teeth. And that food, the bacteria that's eating that food is dissolving the bacteria on your, I mean, dissolving the enamel on your teeth. So anyway, how does it happen? Where does it come from? You lose it because of acidic foods that you like to eat, like citrus fruit is a great example. If you eat a lot of citrus food and you're not brushing your teeth adequately, that acid can eat away at the enamel that's on your teeth. Medications can actually make your enamel wear away faster. Acid reflux, you know, the acid that's in your stomach will literally melt away the enamel that you have on your teeth. So that's bad. You don't want to have acid reflux coming up into your mouth and washing your teeth. They even say if you're going to throw up, put Vaseline over your teeth. Did you guys ever hear
what?
Of that?
What?
If you're going to throw up, cover your teeth in Vaseline so you don't have your what? Stomach acid ruin your teeth.
I don't know that I never had enough warning before I was going to.
Yeah, what the heck?
I haven't thrown up since I was a child.
Yeah, but there, you know, if you're bulimic,
brush your teeth immediately afterwards. Screw the Vaseline.
If you're bulimic, you know, just follow.
Right,
follow,
or if
just,
you, yeah. yeah.
Well,
if you have sick, like, vomiting syndrome.
People who have bulimia, they often give them mouth guards.
Good.
Put in place,
for that reason.
Because otherwise, they will eat their teeth away. Totally.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
So harsh tooth brushing. You need to use the softest toothbrush you can get, right? Just get the ones that say soft. If you're using an electric toothbrush, they typically come with soft heads, and I haven't even seen a way to get firm heads for an electric toothbrush.
Yeah, I don't think – I've never seen a – what's it called? Sonicare with a firm head.
Yeah, me either. So don't push hard. You don't need to. All that needs to happen is those bristles need to get in, get underneath your gums, and they need to get in between your teeth. And pushing hard does not help them do their job. Just don't push hard.
Ooh, and use that water pick.
Yeah.
Are you a water pick brother?
I've used it on and off. I switch over. I'm like, oh, look, I'm using the water pick, and it's great. I mean, you either got to – you have to use a water pick or you a good water pick or you have to floss. You know, you could
– Well, you're supposed to do both.
I floss daily.
I do both.
Every day. You can do both. Using your teeth to open packaging or whatever, hammering nails with your mouth. I mean, don't use your teeth as a tool to do anything.
How about biting earlobes?
That's fine. You can nibble on earlobes all you want because they're smushy.
Are soft.
But there are people that open cans, that open beer bottles with their teeth. You're out of your mind. Every time you do that, you're chipping away at the enamel. You're basically saying, here you go. Here's a spot where I want a cavity, right where that metal touched my teeth. Teeth grinding. A lot of people have it and don't even know they have a problem.
Because they do it in their sleep.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're unconscious.
Yeah, when I say teeth grinding, Ev, I'm not talking about teeth on the dance floor. I'm talking about people who typically do this. They do this when they're stressed out, when they're sleeping, when they're stressed out and sleeping. My dentist literally just gave me a upper tooth guard to sleep with to prevent grinding and also to keep my mouth, my jaw relaxed and open, right? I mean, you know, that your dentist knows a lot or should know a lot and can help you with sleep problems as well. So anyway, one last one. Tooth clenching and misalignment of your jaw. These are a big issue that you should be aware of. You people that tooth clench don't even know that they're doing it. That's when your teeth are not smacking against each other, but like you might be doing a tight jaw. You know, you're biting down on your own teeth. Not good. And the misalignment means that your teeth don't rest on each other properly. And if that's the case, your teeth could be wearing away each other, which you don't want.
Yikes.
Okay, so now I gave you this incredibly important list that you should, you know, if you don't check any of these boxes, great. If you do, do something about it. Trust me.
Dental care is one of those perfect, like, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure examples. And there's a reason why most dental health insurance plans here in the U.S. include teeth cleanings as part of your service. Because if you go in twice a year and get your teeth cleaned and you get your damn x-rays, you're less likely to be dealing with all sorts of horrible stuff later that your dental insurance barely covers.
Yeah, it's preventative, totally.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get back to the lozenge now. Now that you know like how bad and all the different ways that you could lose tooth enamel, and you know maybe you're saying to yourself, man, maybe I have some lost in tooth enamel. So the original design of the lozenge came from Deniz Yucesoy, Yucesoy.
Wait, his name is Deniz?
Deniz, yeah, Deniz.
Yucesoy. Deniz, the dentist?
So he's a graduate student at University of Washington Genetically Engineered Materials Science and Engineering Center. Okay, so this guy's got incredible insight and came up with this idea of a lozenge that will deliver into your mouth the raw material that it needs to re-enamel your teeth. That was his idea. But he's not he's not a part of the research team. So the research team, again, is at the University of Washington, and they are preparing to begin a clinical trial on this lozenge that could help the issue of enamel loss. Now, it contains a genetically engineered peptide, which, you know, this is a chain of amino acids, right? The peptide is derived from a key protein in the creation of tooth enamel called aminogenin. So enamel is found on a tooth's crown, right? This is the outer surface of your teeth. The aminogenin is also key to the formation of cementum. I love that word, cementum. It's like say, take any word like cement and put an at the end. Cementum. Cara-um, right? So
pretty much how things are named in science.
I know, it's just funny. It just sounds so dramatic. It's just cement. So this formation of cementum that's found at the surface of the tooth root, that's where cementum is found. The lozenge also contains phosphorus and calcium ions, and these are two other ingredients that you need to build new tooth enamel. So it puts all that stuff in your mouth. And when a person uses the lozenge, it will deposit several micrometers of brand new tooth enamel on the person's teeth. And the new peptide the researchers created is engineered to bind to tooth enamel that's been damaged. So it will repair the enamel of a person's teeth using, if you do use two lozenges a day, this is like what they've estimated, that it'll give you more tooth enamel. If you use one lozenge a day, it'll maintain what you already have. So according to
how do I get into this clinical trial?
I don't know, but it's I'm fascinated by it. So according to the researchers, the new layers of enamel will integrate with dentin, which is the living tissue found underneath the tooth surface. So it really is like this very, very, you know, I don't want to say optimistic because I'm hoping that this research is legit. I'm hoping that, you know, they've basically found a way to replenish the enamel. The lozenge will be used like a breath mint. And the researchers expect it to be completely safe for adults and children because there's nothing in it that could that can harm you in any way.
Jay, what about
yeah
the addition of the new enamel around fillings, pre-existing fillings?
So I think that is for the study. That's part of the things that they're studying. Let me read a little bit more, Bob, because they have a short list of what they're trying to determine right now with this particular study. But, you know, these studies have to keep going on and on until they can see exactly what, you know, what it's doing to all the different things that could go on in somebody's mouth. This team is led by Mehmet Sarıkaya, the professor in the Department of Materials Research, Science and Engineering, and adjunct professor in the Department of Oral Health Sciences. And he said that they are in talks with corporations, I told you guys this before, for potential commercial applications. So Mehmet said that the team is focusing on three objectives during this particular clinical trial. They want to demonstrate efficacy, of course. They want to document all their findings. And they want to observe from this test a benchmark on how well it whitens teeth. So the teeth whitening effect here is really cool, guys, because it's adding new enamel to your teeth. When it adds this layer of enamel, your teeth become whiter because you're adding brand new pristine enamel.
As opposed to the way most people whiten their teeth, which is kind of etching into their enamel.
Yikes.
Yeah,
it's really not the teeth bleaching is not the healthiest thing.
It's bad.
You shouldn't do it often.
Especially if you have weak enamel as it is.
I would recommend talking to your dentist first. So they've already successfully tested the lozenge on human teeth. On pig and rat teeth. These are like, you know, extracted teeth. They've also tested it on live rats, you know, the live test rat subjects. I don't know how they have them sucking on the lozenge. You know, I'm sure that they have them drinking. It's probably in a liquid or whatever.
Yeah, they probably put it in their water.
They're also planning on creating a toothpaste. Of course, a toothpaste. You know, using it twice a day, two or three times a day. When the new tooth enamel is created, you know, this is real enamel, guys. So the treatment will be much more effective than using fluoride because fluoride doesn't actually rebuild new enamel in the way that like most people think. It just kind of reinforces what you have. So this is a real game changer because if this is real and it isn't poisonous, of course, if it doesn't really have any negative effects, you know, they'll just put this stuff in toothpaste and in breath mints and what have you, and you'll just build enamel. And your dentist will probably say something like, hey, everything looks great. Or, hey, back off the lozenge. You know, don't take as many. You know, your teeth are starting to get big. I don't know. I don't know what would happen if you keep doing it. And it keeps building and building.
Your teeth are getting too big.
Teeth have been weightlifting too much, too powerful.
Hermione teeth.
Oh, I was going to say like in The Mask. Wow, what a date.
Oh, I know, right? I used to call those giant teeth as a joke. Gosh. I'd call those California teeth because they were just like, you know, like these are like the teeth that people like the fake teeth people get. Where their grill is too big.
We used to call them chiclet teeth because they look. You remember chiclets?
Hell yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The little pieces of square gum. They look just like chiclets.
So my final word is I'm really hoping that this is legit, and I will be one of the first people to use it.
Yeah. So obviously we have to see what the study shows. You know that now they're doing a larger clinical trial. So we'll see. They're saying it should only take 3 months, but longer term data might be nice. Also, I wonder because when they talk about benchmarking, they only talk about whitening. I wonder if that's all they're really going for is just whitening the teeth, or if there will be enough enamel to like reduce tooth sensitivity, reduce the risk of cavities.
I love that.
I mean, that's obviously going to be longer term research, like the real, not just cosmetic, but actual, you know, dental benefits.
Yeah, they're working on a formula for tooth sensitivity Steve.
Yeah. Yep. And I think the real innovation here, because if you say, why would it take so long? What's so special about the enamel that it took so long to be able to replace it? Because you can't just slap calcium on there, you know, or phosphate. You need something to incorporate it into the existing enamel. And that's what the genetically engineered peptide does. So that's really the innovation, in my opinion, is that peptide. Because that will then... You know, that's what will add the minerals to the enamel and build the enamel.
Jay, how thick are the layers? Microns, did you say?
Micrometers, yeah. Let me see.
I like how you say micrometer.
Micrometer.
micrometer. That's cute.
Micrometer.
I mean that's you know, not much. I mean,
yeah, that's why you got to do it every day.
What, for a century? I mean, that's pretty damn thin.
Hey, Bob, don't you dare talk bad about this.
Yeah, but how thick is enamel? I don't know.
Well, I think the idea
how
is
thin is a.
They said if you do it every day, you'll then be treading water, right? You'll base that's I guess that's how much your enamel.
Once a day, one lozenge a day.
That's how much it wears down a day. If you do it twice a day, then you'll be building back your enamel at the same rate you would have been losing it. So, I mean, the goal is, you know, not to instantly give you perfect teeth, but just to allow your teeth to last another 10, 20 years, right? That's, or 30 years or whatever.
Gosh, if you could reduce sensitivity with this, it would be such a game changer.
Yeah. All right, guys, I'm going to talk about another potential game changer. I kind of had the same type of news item as Jay. In that I'm like, is this real? And what's the thing that doesn't work here? And I couldn't find anything so far. So let me tell you about the graphene aluminum ion batteries. These obviously have been been developed over years, but they're getting pretty close to commercialization. You know, this is, we're not talking about, 5, 10 years, whatever, proof of concept. This is like, their commercial prototypes will be in production this year. All right, so we've talked a lot about battery technology. And as I always have to point out, batteries are one of those things that in order for them to be useful, they need to have a suite of characteristics all at the same time. And lacking any one of them could be a deal killer, right? So these batteries would need to have good energy density, right? They can't be huge. They need to have good specific energy, which means they can't be too massive. They need to have good power density, depending on what you're going to use them for, right? If you're using them for a watch, not so much. If you're using them for a car, they need a lot. You know, that's like how much power could they produce over time versus how much do they store per volume versus how much do they store per weight, right? So they need to have reasonable parameters for all of those things. They also need to be stable, right? They
can't blow up.
Yeah, they don't want them to blow up or catch fire or spontaneously discharge too quickly, right?
Oh, yeah, that'd be bad.
Yeah, imagine your car is sitting there for a couple of days and the battery's dead just because it just spontaneously leaks energy.
Bob has that problem.
Whoops.
Needs to have many charge discharge cycles so that lifespan of the battery is reasonable. It'd be awfully nice if it weren't made out of rare, extremely expensive or toxic substances, right?
Mm-hmm. Also didn't weigh like 1 million pounds.
Yeah, well, I said that's the specific energy.
I thought you were saying size, not weight.
That's both. I said both.
Okay.
But you're right, though. both are important and some more than others, depending, like for your laptop, size is probably more important for your car. They both are, but definitely weight becomes more important when you're, you know, moving around.
And for your house, neither matters that much.
Yeah, but in your house, really, neither matter. Yeah. Exactly. You know, within limits, just that you have a lot more, battery can't be bigger than your house.
Can't collapse into a black hole.
And if it's recyclable, that's kind of a bonus. That'd be kind of nice if the materials are easily recyclable. And they have to be abundant as well. You know, they can't be, you know, super rare, especially if we're going to try to build the new economy out of this. All right, so lithium-ion batteries have all of those features quite reasonably, not perfectly. They do occasionally burst into flames if they overheat them. They have good, you know, good energy density, specific density, good sufficient power density for cars. They have good charge-discharge cycles. You know, you could get 10 years out of them in a car or more, and they're getting better all the time. In fact, especially since the electric vehicles are ramping up, the battery technology is really accelerating. I mean, the lithium ion battery prices are dropping pretty quickly. They're just getting better in every way. Now, we've been following battery technology for, I don't know, at least 20 years, if not longer, you know, fairly closely. And, you know, we've mentioned this pattern of like all these breakthroughs never seem to happen, but they do all add up to a pretty steady incremental advance to the point that they're a lot better now than they were 10 years ago and much better than they were 20 years ago. Probably the last game changer was when we shifted from nickel metal hydride batteries to lithium ion batteries. So the big question in the back of our heads has always been, all right, when's the next shift going to be to a new technology that's going to make a little bit of a leap and then resume the incremental advances? So we may be there. We may be getting close to that. And that's the graphene aluminum ion batteries. So similar technology to lithium ion batteries, but they use graphene and they use aluminum as the ion carrier. Now, aluminum has an advantage over lithium in that lithium carries one electron per molecule and aluminum carries three with an atom that's about the same size. So that triples the energy density of lithium ion batteries. But aluminum atoms weigh a little bit more than three times as much as lithium. So the energy, the specific energy, the energy per mass won't be very different, maybe even a little worse, but the energy per volume will be three times more. So the batteries will basically, the same size battery will get you three times as far, but it will also weigh a little bit more than three times as much. Not that big a deal, actually, you know, considering that's pretty much keeping up with the range, but it'll be cheaper. So basically you'll get three times the range for a little bit less of the cost of a lithium ion battery. Something like that. That's it's kind of where, you know, we'll know when they start really mass producing it. So that's pretty good. You know, that's pretty good. So if you there's an Australian company who says that they are also, they're a graphene production company, and they've partnered with, you know, other companies to, so they have the ability to mass produce the graphene and also to make the batteries, the aluminum ion batteries, and they said that they'll be coming out with the coin size batteries in 6 months, with like cell phone, laptop batteries in 18 months, and electric vehicle batteries in 2024. That's their projection.
So this is one of the game changers that we've been waiting for.
I think so. I'm hoping so. I mean, again, I'm always like, I'll believe it when I actually see it. But so far, all the indications look okay. I haven't been able to find that gotcha. You know, like, what's the thing like? Oh, yeah, it you know, but it only could be recharged 20 times. You know, like, what's the one thing that all we have to do is figure out how to scale it up or whatever?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like,
it's killing the scientists who are working on it, but we'll figure that out.
Yeah. So it seems like in every way, it seems to be at least as good, if not superior, to the lithium ion battery. There's actually one feature I didn't mention about batteries. You need to be able to recharge them quickly. You know, lithium ion batteries charge fast enough that you could recharge your car overnight, but the aluminum ion batteries recharge between 20 and 70 times faster.
Ooh, that's huge.
That's 70. Huge. So now you're talking about, instead of charging up overnight, you're charging up over lunch. You know what I mean? Or
yeah,
just
right.
Or a long bathroom break, like you stop on the highway to buy snacks and go to the bathroom. You plug your car in for 15, 20 minutes. And you've got, you know, you've topped off your mileage a little bit. You've added some decent mileage. Now, of course, the battery isn't the only limiting factor to how quickly it charges. The electrical source is as well. But there's already like fast charging stations. But the problem with fast charging lithium ion batteries is that it actually reduces their life expectancy. But if these batteries, you know, or naturally can be charged, you don't have to overclock them or whatever, you know, you don't have to overcharge them or overdrive them. If these like will just soak up the energy 20 times, you know, faster, even at the low estimate, then the fast charging stations should just dump energy into them fairly quickly.
You mentioned that, that the coin batteries will be out soon and then the whatever, and then eventually the car batteries. Are they in proof of concept right now? Like, are people using these things? Is it still on paper?
No, they have them. Yeah, they're producing them now. They'll be hitting the market in 6 months. 6 months means they have the factory. They're building them.
Months means it'll be like in consumers' hands.
Yes,
then.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes. Although I don't think it's going to be for like open distribution. It's going to be for consumer, so that consumers can have them and test them in the real world. But they will be producing them. I don't think they have the factories all scaled up to like flood the market with them. You know what I mean? But, and this is not the only company working on this technology. This is basically happening. You know what I mean? That's the bottom line. It'll be interesting though, because, you know, because of, you know, Tesla and EVs and everything, the lithium ion battery technologies are really accelerating in terms of their incremental advances. I wonder like what the difference will really be by the time they actually get to the market. Like in 2024, when these things are allegedly going to be ready for electric vehicles, the lithium-ion batteries are going to be a lot better by then too. But I still think there'll be an improvement. You know, it'll even just moving to a new material, even being more environmentally friendly, the much faster recharge time, all of that is going to be a significant advantage. So this, I think, could be a tipping point for electric vehicles. I mean, I think we've already passed a tipping point in that they're cost effective, and for like 95%+ of the uses, the range anxiety really isn't there. But this would get us past, I think, that final tipping point where there's really no reason not to buy an electric vehicle. You know, there's really no reason for range anxiety, and the price should be really on a par with an internal combustion engine. At that point, you know, you could get the same 300-mile range for less than a third the cost of the battery, you know, saving you thousands of dollars on the car. Or you, if you want the 600-mile range car, you could spend a little bit more for that, whatever. I mean, depending on how you plan on using your vehicle. So I hope this is as advertised, that I hope, you know, I did a lot of researching to find anything I could about this. Couldn't find any deal killers or any hidden things that they're glossing or whatever. It seems to be all legit. So, but this is always a good thing about this show, is I'm sure there's somebody out there who has some kind of industry insider connection, insight. If there's anything I'm missing, or if there is any insider information, please let us know. We'll do a follow-up, and I'll definitely be keeping a close eye on this one. So this is definitely a putting it on your radar kind of news item. Graphene aluminum ion batteries. This may be the next lithium ion battery in a few years. All right, Evan, finish up with an update on bee venom therapy.
Yeah. So the last time I did a news item concerning bee venom therapy was about 3 years ago. And seeing as how I used up most of my best bee puns then, I'll get right to the news item. Yeah. You guys remember those puns,
oh, yeah.
Right?
I look at them every day.
Yes, as you should. All right. Courtesy of Reuters, the headline reads, Libyan patients turn to bee stings for pain relief. Okay. Now, the report actually has a decent opening line. It says, in a substitute for modern medicine, a doctor in Libya is treating his patients by stinging them with bees. Okay, substitute for modern medicine. That's fairly accurate, right? This doctor's name is Mohammed Al-Zawawi, and he's an apitherapy practitioner in the northern city of Misrata. Now, apitherapy is the use of substances from honeybees to relieve various medical conditions. And this stuff has been studied. And from one study, I pulled this little tidbit. In sensitized persons, venom compounds can act as allergens, causing the release of mast cell mediators and a spectrum of allergic reactions that can range from mild local swelling to severe systemic reactions, anaphylactic shock, and even death. Furthermore, repeated exposure to the allergen was found to carry a greater risk of severe allergic reactions than in the general population. And in 2015, there was a study published in PLOS One that found that compared with normal saline injection, bee venom acupuncture showed a 261% increased relative risk for the occurrence of adverse effects. So, despite all that, Dr. Zawawi and many other apitherapy practitioners like him believe that live bee therapy or bee venom therapy is not only useful for pain treatment, but that it supports the treatment of a variety of diseases. And we have actually spoken about this many times before. Steve, I know you've written about how practitioners of bee venom therapy use it for multiple sclerosis relief, among other things. As this article explains, one of the doctor's patients, his name is Ismail Isi, who is a boy, and he's ill with leukemia. Oh, but his father says the bee stings are definitely helping him. So here's how it reads. He says, my son has a tumor. It was leukemia, but afterwards it spread to his bones. We came to visit this doctor who uses bees, and thank God there has been some improvement. His right eye had become swollen, but has since shown improvement, thank God. We hope he gets well soon with the help of this doctor. But the practice remains controversial within the medical field. Yes, at least they acknowledge that. And there are plenty of health experts who are saying that the risks and side effects outweigh its purported benefits. Purported benefits definitely being the key there. Here's the pattern we see with bee venom therapy, is that you get desperate people And in this case, this is a child who's been struck with this god-awful diagnosis of leukemia. And the parents, in some level of desperation, are turning to the pseudoscience in hopes of a miracle, which is the pattern that we definitely see. And there's also a part of the report that explains that at first the Zawawi says that people in his area were unsure about alternative medicine, but word of mouth has helped his business grow with an increasing number of patients seeking help. So there you go. The susceptibility of claims for these miracle cures with anecdotal information regarding the therapies, certainly not backed up by the science. But bee venom therapy has something of a foothold in Libya. There have been several studies in recent years that have been conducted in Libya and by professors and scientists at Libyan universities. Some of the studies claim to show therapeutic benefits, and others are discovering that it not only has no benefits, but it's actually harmful. And there was also a recent news article that talked about this particular study from January in 2021, which was published in the Open Veterinary Journal. I have no idea what level of of pedigree that holds, but in any case, these were doctors and scholars at the Libyan Academy of Postgraduate Studies, the University of Tripoli, so local doctors and local professors working on this study, who found that people have been in Libya, in particular, have been using bee venom therapy for infertility. And that's been a practice. It's become a popular method, they say. And even though the literature does not find any published studies that really investigated the use of bee venom therapy for infertility treatment. But here's what they say. The findings of this study showed that repeated bee venom treatment by stinger injection to adult male mice, so this was a mouse study, it resulted in a significant decline in testosterone levels, decline in sperm count, sperm motility, and a very significant increase in the percentage of abnormal sperm morphology. And also there were harmful testicular histological changes in the structural organization, seminiferous tubules, and degenerative changes in the germinal epithelium compared to control group.
That means it's no bueno for your wee-wee.
Right, basically. Now, it's a mouse study, so we know, you know, we know the limitations of mouse studies, so I don't think we should necessarily get all up in arms about one study, but they are saying they basically there's a desperate need for educating alternative healthcare practitioners that these are the potential risks, potential harmful effects, and certainly anything like that totally outweighs any kind of relief you can possibly get from bee venom therapy.
Yeah, you're not going to get relief from leukemia. And the really sad thing is that, like, depending on the type of leukemia, because obviously there are variations, it's very survivable for children if they get the appropriate
if they can get the appropriate treatment. How much of this, you know, is the financial aspects of it, or the access to that medicine? I'm sure that all plays a big part of it. Where there is a void, unfortunately, alternative medicine practitioners will move in and ply their trade.
Yeah, not even where there's a void, just wherever they could again lure in desperate patients. Right. You know, it's not just where there isn't, you know, viable treatment. It's instead of viable treatment in many cases. So I first wrote about this 25 years ago. I've been basically following sort of in the background whenever anything gets published with bee venom therapy. And they've been spinning their wheels for 25 years, making no progress because, you know, as a treatment, it's worthless. You know, of course, now there's a lot of chemicals in there. And if you look at the individual components, I'm sure there's a lot of potentially exploitable, you know, pharmaceutical agents
like
in there.
Right, like snake venom. Yeah, like, there's a lot of good that can come from synthesizing and purifying and utilizing
it as
a drug.
That's the key. Yeah. You know, yeah, you purify some specific component of it. And use it in a specific way, but instead just giving this toxic brew of literally, you know, like with dozens and dozens of different chemicals, which evolved to cause harm. Right, this is a defense mechanism, and I love the anti-inflammatory thing about it, you know, because that's you're often going to find these kind of basic science studies where they put whatever in a petri dish and claim that it has anti-inflammatory effects. But you know, that's just, you could find that in anything. If you could pick and choose the markers you want to look at, you could make that kind of claim. Or you could say it boosts the immune system. It's kind of the same thing. Like, you're just looking for things to change. And there's so many things you could look at in terms of, you know, components of the immune system, that you could make whatever claim you want for anything. You know, it's really kind of useless.
Yep.
In any case, there's absolutely no reason from any perspective to think that there's any clinical benefit to just raw bee venom. Right. But it's just not going to go away because it, you know, unscrupulous practitioners will use it and make money off of it. Off
Oh, yeah. Yep, and there's a market for it, unfortunately.
And it ultimately comes down to just the appeal to nature fallacy. You know, it's natural. Yeah, it's a natural venom. That's right, you're correct.
Yeah, exactly. There's also an appeal to antiquity in there. And they've been using it for hundreds of years. Okay.
Which is probably not even true.
Right.
Probably a fake appeal to antiquity.
Take this hemlock. It's natural, too.
Yeah.
Bees are killing people for hundreds of years.
Jay, who's that noisy time?
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy. So you guys recognize this, right?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Yes. Yeah, listen to him say
the words.
Riders on the storm. So this, it's not what you think, though, because it has been changed to a major key.
Is that the trick? Mm-hmm.
That's the trick, and I'm telling you this because so many people guessed, and the interest here is what people thought it was. Like, first off, somebody won, of course, because there was the first person that guessed. This is a different kind of noisy because it was really, really obvious. I wanted to see like how quickly someone could guess, and then I just want to talk about how cool this effect is. There's lots of songs that you can go online and listen to it. But what's also interesting is that people didn't guess correctly, right? Because people, you know, there's just so much information in people's brains out there that they're going to hear something that might be obvious to you, and to them, they hear something else, or they don't, you know, the light bulb doesn't go on in the same way. So as an example, Mark White wrote in, he said, "Hi Jay, is this the sound coming from a stylus needle while the record is playing?" So yeah, he says the record is Riders on the Storm by the Doors, but he thought it was this is a weird phenomenon that happens. If you play a record without the speakers on, but the turntable is spinning and the needle is on it, you can hear the music.
Mm-hmm. Oh, weird.
Yep. The vibration of the needle will produce some sound waves that distort the music. You know, distort. It sounds like, you know, it's really.
It like amplifies it itself.
Yeah. They're just the vibration is vibrating the air. And that vibration, instead of it going through the needle and turning into an electrical signal, it's just vibrating the head of the, you know, of the needle. Eric Dolly came in with a guess. He says, "I think this is an AI trying to continue Riders on the Storm based on an input sample of the song." So he's saying like they input the song into an AI system, and the AI is continuing to write the song, you know, and interpreting it as it heard it. I think that's pretty interesting. And I'm sure at some point with AI, you're going to be able to say, you know, take the Police second album and write another album that sounds like that album, you know, and I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. We're seeing it with art, right?
Absolutely.
Take all the paintings by Dalí and then produce a new painting.
The Rembrandt that we saw.
Oh, was it a Rembrandt? Gotcha.
Yeah, it was Rembrandt. It was gorgeous. Artist, yeah. Fantastic work that the AI did, which is, you know, ultimately the computer programmers and researchers that did that as well. Another guest, Justice Smith, wrote in, "Hey, Jay, to my ears, that sounds like an authentic recording of the Doors playing Riders on the Storm. But since nothing can be that simple on Who's That Noisy, I'm going to guess that someone has altered it in some way using modern technology. I know, right? Was it originally a very poor quality live recording that has been enhanced using AI?" So he picked up on the fact that it was a little off in a sense, right?
Yeah, it sounds like most people picked up on that. It was like kind of off, but they couldn't put their finger on why.
The winner from last week is Kvist, K-V-I-S-T, Kvist, Kvist, Kvist. I don't know.
Clown.
That's a pretty cool name. Eric Kvist. He says, "Howdy, the Who's That Noisy is Riders on the Storm changed into a major key." So if you want to hear a couple of other songs changed into a major key, Smells Like Teen Spirit, when changed into a major key, doesn't even sound like the same song anymore.
Oh, I think George just did that on stage.
Yeah,
did he?
Yeah, he did.
He would do that.
But when they take the real recording and the real vocals and they just transpose it using their software that can do it very, very easily, it's really fascinating to hear it because it certain songs don't recognize them. They're just not the same song anymore. So thank you all for writing it in. I thought that was really cool. The original file was sent to me by Vanessa Landscheidt, S-H-E-I-D-T, Landscheidt, right? Scheidt? All right, so I have a fun noisy this week. This week's noisy was sent in by Ian. Ian, our tech guru, master, wizard. My God, Ian has become so integral into my the SGU. God. He doesn't like it when I say things like, you're awesome, but he is awesome. He was away visiting family this weekend, and he got this, I think, from his brother-in-law. So I want you to tell me what you think it is.
That's weird.
Wow, the
weird.
Background noise sounds like the old Star Trek phaser noise.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that in there. Now, I'll tell you right out of the gate, as I was editing this audio with my headphones on, I could hear some human voices in the background. Maybe it was coming from a TV. Just ignore that. It is the primary noise up front that I want you to identify. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, if you heard something cool, you got it. You just got to send it to me. You never know. It might be perfect for Who's That Noisy. Email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, the SGU is busy.
Yeah, I know. We got a lot of stuff coming up.
So we have, in order of how they happen, we have Nexus, NECSS.org. This is our yearly conference. We used to do it in person. Now we're doing it virtual because of COVID and because we found out we could spend a lot more time and energy working on quality and not having to worry about, booking 30 people's airline tickets, right? Big difference in how we spend our time. We'd really like to do an in-person event at some point, but we're thinking that we might do this at least for the next couple of years and see how things go. I really enjoy the virtual conference because it's a different experience. It's just a different
thing. So many
more thing.
People can come.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It's like people from all over the world, you guys can come. You don't have to fly here.
I mean, that was the real thing that blew our minds last year. The turnout was so good. Oh, me too, Bob. Bob, trust me. I do too, man. I do too. But, the amount of money that we have to put out to do an in-person conference, it's ridiculous. It's around $100,000 that we have to put at risk. This is, exceptionally less expensive and much, so many more people got to experience Nexus last year. It's a hard decision to make. We're doing it virtual this year. We'll tell you year by year, but please do join us. We have an incredible list of speakers. You can go to our website and check it out. George Church is our keynote. He's going to tell you things about CRISPR that you never heard about before. The future has landed. That is the theme of this year's Nexus. We will be admiring and basically hearing details about technology that exists today, like throat lozenges that are for your teeth and battery technology that finally happened. We'll say, no, but we're talking about things like CRISPR and the mRNA platform. We'll be talking about, of course, space travel and a lot of other things. Go to our website, check it out, and please join us this year.
What with CRISPR coming up in all?
That'd been perfect. Then we go to DragonCon. The next event that the SGU will do is we will be having a private show, a private recording at DragonCon. It's a very small, intimate show. We have a lot of fun. We're off the rails. We're usually wearing costumes of some sort. And then the very next day, we will be doing an extravaganza in Atlanta, off-site. It's not a DragonCon event, but it will not be far from the DragonCon hotels. So please go to our website to check out all the details on that. Go to theskepticsguide.org/events. Then we have three more events coming up, and all of them are in Denver. So the first one is on November 18th. We will be in Denver at a science museum doing the extravaganza. And then on the 19th, this is Friday night, we will be doing a live show, which you can attend. And then we drive to Fort Collins on Saturday night, and we will be doing another live show in Fort Collins. All of these are in Denver. You can go to our website. Again, like I said, go to /events. You find out all the details. And then after that, it's Thanksgiving and Christmas. And that's all I got for you.
All right, great. We have one quick email. I don't see a name attached to this. But this, I'll just read it. It says, I am a social worker, psychotherapist, and family mediator working in Ontario, Canada. In my field, there's a lot of recent talk about the differences between right brain, left brain. I have pasted a link to one of the gurus in my field, Bill Eddy, an American family mediator social worker who does a lot of training and programming for folks in my profession. And he goes on to say, do the left and right sides of our brain do such different tasks? I won't read the rest of it, but basically we've talked about this before, but you know, we get an email. It's a good reminder. And Carrie, you know this as well. The left brain, right brain thing is nonsense, basically. The idea is that like if you're a left brain person, then you're logical and analytical. And if you're a right brain person, then you're intuitive and emotional. It's a gross oversimplification. So yes, right. Some functions do lateralize, like
for sure the left and the right side of the brain lateralize, but you have both of them.
Well, it's every not only that has it's not both. Just that you have both and they work together. It's not like you're only one side is, you know, functioning, the other side isn't.
Yeah.
Is that the brain has networks, right? And networks undergo specific functions, and the right brain and the left brain network together. Like you can't separate them. You know what I mean? Like there might be one function that's occurring on both sides of the brain.
So Steve, what you're saying is, and this is the thing that I find interesting, because of the physiology of the brain and the fact that we have two lobes, it's an easy assumption
hemispheres.
You're right. You're totally right. I'm sorry. We have two hemispheres.
Yeah.
Right. So people think, oh, they're separate. You know, you can see them. They look like they're separate. The fact is they are functioning together as one unit. It's one system.
Right. Unless the corpus callosum is cut.
Right. I was going to say, for the most part, there is lateralization. And I think that's important to point out, because I think the problem is that a lot of people take this to the extreme. It is true that language in most people, the vast majority of people, is lateralized to the left hemisphere. Prosody of language is lateralized to the right hemisphere. Prosody meaning the musicality of language, the tone, the emotionality. And I think oftentimes that simple fact gets translated to the idea that left brain people are analytical and right brain people are emotional, which is the most ridiculous and gross oversimplification of a fundamental lateralization within the brain. But for sure, if people have a massive stroke on one side of their brain in a particular area, they can lose certain capabilities and they can lose, you know, they can lose language or they can lose motor function.
Yeah, yeah. But those lateralized functions or that localized discretely like that tend to be very discrete, you know, like...
Yeah, they're discrete, like language. Yeah.
But all the higher functions, like the things people are usually talking about, like personality... And executive function, all this kind of stuff. These are all bilateral. These do not lateralize.
Right.
Right. That's why your brain can function.
Like there's some, you know, there is some stuff that we can point to, but this idea, you're right, that somehow it translates into somebody having a different personality or to somebody being a different kind of person because they're utilizing parts of their brains differently is bananas.
Yeah, yeah. So it's basically
not true.
It's grossly overplaying the lateralization, the implications of that, and underappreciating the integration of the two hemispheres at many levels and the redundancy and the bilaterality of some of the higher functions, et cetera. So it just doesn't boil down to there are right brain people or, you know, right and left brain people. It just doesn't work. So just get rid of it. It's not useful. It's not useful. Just get rid of it. Let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Three regular news items this week. You guys ready?
Yep.
Ready.
All right, here we go. Item number one, researchers report that they have effectively cured type 1 diabetes in mice by implanting insulin-secreting cells made from stem cells and protected in a nanofiber cage to prevent immune attack. Item number two, scientists have demonstrated they can reprogram heart scar tissue directly into cardiac cells using specific proteins delivered through a viral vector. And item number three, new research finds that, paradoxically, as emotional intensity increases from mild to strong, the ability to classify the emotion from vocalizations alone decreases.
What do you mean by vocalizations?
In other words, you can't see the person. You can only hear what they're saying. Can we hear the noises that they're making? Can we hear the noises?
Oh, we're classifying it in somebody who's experiencing it, not the experiencer is classifying it.
Yeah. Another person is trying to figure out what emotion is that person having just by listening to them. And the intensity of the emotion goes up, the ability to classify the emotion goes down. All right, Evan, go first.
Okay. Effectively cured type 1 diabetes in mice. You implant insulin-secreting cells made from stem cells. Okay, no problem there. And protected in a nanofiber cage. Bob, you like that?
I do.
To prevent immune attack. So I am going to invoke the Perry rule here that when Steve uses the word nano in science or fiction, it is science. So that's the old Perry rule.
Good to know.
Am I remembering that correctly? I hope so. Because
you said that about a lot of things, though, but yeah.
That's my story. I'm sticking to it. The next one about the scientists that demonstrated they can reprogram heart scar tissue directly into cardiac cells. Wow. Using specific proteins delivered through a viral vector. Well, we know we've spoken about those before, and they are innovative ways of getting things to where they need to go. But gee whiz, reprogramming heart scar tissue. Can you reprogram scar tissue into cardiac cells? Into cardiac cells themselves? Scar tissues? That's amazing. That one's almost too good to be true. I'm going to hold off on that one for the moment as I look at number three. As emotional intensity increases from mild to strong, the ability to classify the emotion from vocalization alone decreases. I don't quite understand why that would be the case. I'm not really picking up on anything here.
That's why it says paradoxically.
Yeah. That is kind of the descriptor for this whole news item. Well, the paradox itself, huh? Yeah. All right. Well, that one's of the three, the strangest. So I guess I'll invoke the strange rule, and the stranger it is, the more likely it might be to be science in this particular game. Therefore, that leaves me with the heart scar tissue directly into cardiac cells. Too good to be true. That one's just too pie in the sky, maybe. So I'll say that one's the fiction.
Which one? Okay.
Heart scar tissue.
All right, Bob.
Using stem cells to create insulin secreting. I mean, and the nanofiber cage. I mean, this seems like at least two or three incremental steps in one. I don't track this closely to know, where we have been with it, but that just seems a little bit farther than I would think. Let's see, the cardiac cell one using a viral vector. That's pretty slick, but that strikes me as potentially doable at this point. And they're not doing this in people. I'm sure this is probably done in rats. And then this third one here, the emotional intensity and the vocalization. I mean, I can make sense of this either way, that there's just so much variation in people that, and their reactions to intense emotions that you can't really dial in, their state just based on listening to them. But that said, I think I'm going to metagame this a little bit and say that the two crazy genetic ones up top are science, and that this fluffy, more fluffy one, if you will, is going to be the science. I mean, it's going to be the fiction.
So I was like, they can't all be science.
The vocalization is fiction.
So the emotion one is fiction. All right, Kara?
Can I get a recap? Bob thinks emotion's fiction, and Evan thinks what?
The heart
is fiction.
The second one.
Yeah. Oh, see, I think the diabetes one might be fiction.
Ooh. There you go.
I don't know. Nice. So they're basically putting beta cells back into, but in a cage. I mean, it's in mice, so they could do that. Let me see. So they've, but the idea, I don't know. The thing that bothers me is this use of the term effectively cured. Like maybe they're treating it, but I'm not really sure how implanting insulin secreting cells is much different than injecting insulin. That's not a cure.
Well,
it's a treatment.
If you inject it once and then you're done, and never need to inject it again.
No, that's still not a cure.
I mean, you're creating your own insulin. That's like saying that. I'll stop.
No, that's like saying that, but that some sort of implant is a cure, like that a pacemaker is a cure for heart fibrillations. It's a treatment. It's still an implant that's in your body that you have to keep up with.
Well, I'll say, Kara, the implication there is that the cells are functioning like normal insulin cells, right? They're secreting insulin in response to blood sugar.
Okay, I see. I see. So there's a feedback mechanism that the body is giving it, and it's not. Yeah. Okay. You're not having to test the blood sugar. Oh gosh. And then reprogram a heart scar tissue directly into cardiac cells, proteins of the viral vector. I mean, that's awesome. But you would think that would have to be like stem cells would be involved, but I don't know. Right? Like at least precursor cells somehow. To reprogram, you usually are requiring some sort of precursor cell. And then the paradoxical thing I totally get. I see a lot of emotion in the work that I do. It is very, very hard to know the difference between somebody who is having panic versus somebody who's overwhelmed with happiness. Sometimes it looks like they're in pain. Sometimes people who are very, very, very sad get frozen and actually don't make a lot of vocalizations. It's really esoteric the way that we process our emotions. So, this is a tough one. I was leaning towards the diabetes one, but now with the clarification, I'm thinking it might be the reprogramming of the heart scar tissue. I feel like there have to be stem cells involved in that.
Is that your answer?
Yeah.
All right. And Jay.
I don't think in the first one that the nanofiber cage, I don't know, man. I don't think that we could do that yet. There's something about that that I don't like. That's it. I don't want, the first one is not science to me.
Oh.
Okay. So you guys are spread out. So I guess I'll take them in order. Researchers report that they have effectively cured type 1 diabetes in mice by implanting insulin-secreting cells made from stem cells and protected in a nanofiber cage to prevent immune attack. Jay, you think this one is a fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Yay.
This is very cool. So, they took the fibroblasts from the mice and made them into stem cells and then made them into insulin secreting beta cells. And that's why there would be no rejection, right? Because they're made from the mouse's own cells. And they not only secrete insulin, but they are doing it in response to the blood sugar level. So they function like normal pancreatic cells. And therefore it's effectively, as long as they survive, it's an effective cure for type 1 diabetes. Now, if that's the case, if they're made from the animal's own stem cells, why do they need to be protected from immune attacks? Anybody know the answer to that?
Because the stem cells haven't been like stamped with your specific...
No, they're their own stem cells.
Well, I mean, because of the fundamental problem with type 1 diabetes
exactly.
is that the beta cells are burning out.
It's because type 1 diabetes is caused by an autoimmune attack of the beta cells themselves.
So you put new beta cells, they're going to be destroyed too.
Yeah, exactly. They'll just be destroyed like the original beta cells were destroyed. So they had to protect them from the immune system. So they made this nanofiber cage to put them in, and they had to experiment with different size openings until they found this sweet spot where the insulin could get out, but immune cells were too big to get in. And so that's what they found, and this worked.
Oh, right, because immune cells are big.
Yeah, they're big.
Oh, I like that. That's smart.
Wow, man. Yeah.
So it's literally like a shark cage.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, they call it awesome. The nanofiber integrated cell encapsulation device. the technical name.
The aluminum
30. Which is nice. But so it's
the molecular man.
So that's pretty cool, and again, it did combine a few different things there. Actually, Bob said like several incremental advances here all at the same time, but this clearly the research needs to move on to humans, and this obviously would not be effective for type 2 diabetes, where the primary problem is that there's insulin resistance. It's not that the cells aren't dead, it's not that they're not making insulin, although they can get burned out because you have to overproduce insulin in order to try to get more of a signal. You know what I mean? In order to get a normal insulin signal, you need to like produce a lot of it. And that just causes more resistance, then it burns out the cells so they can't produce it, then they crash. You know, it's a huge problem. But just making more insulin is not going to solve that issue. Okay, let's move on to number two. Scientists have demonstrated they can reprogram heart scar tissue directly into cardiac cells using specific proteins delivered through a viral vector. Evan and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Mm-hmm. Bob and Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is
Say it.
Science.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, it is. Holy moly.
Wow. Bob gets the solo win, but before we get to
nice,
that, so this is cool. This
time.
Doesn't it feel good, Bob?
So, Kara, you said there have to be stem cells in there somewhere, but what do they make stem cells from?
Stems?
Stem protein? Wood.
Fibroblasts. From fibroblasts, right?
Yeah.
And what are fibroblasts? They make scar tissue.
Yeah.
So they just said, hey, why don't we just make the stem cells out of the fibroblasts that are forming the scar tissue and then convert them into cardiac cells.
This is awesome.
And then you just convert the scar tissue in the heart, like after a heart attack, directly into cardiac cells and cardiac myocytes. And then you're good. But cool. So they did it. You know what the proteins are?
The proteins that actually reprogram them? No, I have
yes,
no idea.
Yeah, it's transcription factors. Or transcription factors.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So they're just telling the DNA to do
Yeah, they're saying, to activate these genes, not those genes. Yeah, transcribe these genes. Mm-hmm. So they just, rather than altering the genes, they just alter the gene expression so that they express cardiac myocyte genes and they just turn into myocytes. And it worked. However, the research... it only reprogrammed about 1 to 1.5% of the cells. So they still have a long way to go.
No, it worked.
But it worked. It's
barely.
A proof of concept. They just need to get more effective. Probably something to do with the efficacy of the vector. Who knows?
The classic problem. How do you get it to all the cells you want to get it to?
Yeah, exactly. So, but, it's interesting that you could just, reprogram cells in the body itself. Rather than adding cells, you don't add stem cells, you just reprogram the cells that are already there. So it's a new idea. Yeah,
just extrapolate
especially
that
because,
a little bit.
Yeah, I know.
That's
right.
That's pretty
the thing.
Epic.
If they,
well,
if
and
they,
it's especially cool in this situation because they're not just reprogramming cells that are already there. They're reprogramming the bad cells that are there, the cells that are causing the problem into cells that are healthy. It's like the scar tissue in the heart. Which is problematic.
There's also an issue with these cells adhering to the other cardiac cells. So they have to fix that problem as well. There's probably other transcription factors that they need to get in there. But yeah, but this approach definitely has a lot of potential. All right. All this means that new research finds that paradoxically, as emotional intensity increases from mild to strong, the ability to classify the emotion from vocalizations alone decreases is the fiction. Because it increases, it gets easier to classify the emotion as the intensity of the emotion increases. However, there's one exception to that, and that is when you get to the most intense emotions. So basically from mild to strong, it increases, but then when you get to intense, it dramatically decreases. But the thing is, it's only at the extreme end of the scale. I suspect because at that point everything is just screaming. You know what I mean? At that point, it all kind of mishmashes together.
But the interesting thing is, people can't identify that that's stronger.
No, they can't identify which emotion it is.
That's
the thing. They can't identify which emotion it is. So if you go from mild to moderate or moderate to strong. It gets easier to tell which emotion it is. But when you go from strong to intense, like the most intense, then it tanks.
God, I completely misread this
one. Oh, sorry. But that's how...
we're talking about an intensity gradient and then people's ability based on the
classify
intensity
the emotion.
Expressing to categorize the emotion.
Yes.
Got it.
To classify
it's
the
like,
emotion.
It's like the grand unification of forces. At sufficiently high temperature, all the forces merge into one.
Yes, it's sufficiently totally high that. Emotional intensity. Everything is basically just screaming. Yeah, people,
that's kind of true. Or it's either just screaming or actually numbness.
Or yelling or just, or what, I don't know. There's little research on this prior to this. What research there is shows that there is a relationship. This is the most extensive study of this, and this is the first to show this sort of at the very high end, this dip.
Yeah.
But yeah, the consensus of research is that as intensity increases, the ability to identify it increases as well.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
So good job, Bob.
Thank you.
It's been a while since you've had a solo win.
Huh? Yes. Yeah, rub it in. When I win. Rub it in. Rub it in.
Good job, Bob. You really have, this is rare for you, huh?
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
a
Bob.
Rare
wow.
experience.
Yeah, the blind squirrel found the acorn.
I believed in you, Bob. That's why I picked the other one, because I wanted you to have a solo win.
Thank you. Thank
that's
you, Jay.
Extra.
The stop
shitty.
Clock is right twice a day.
That was a pity win, Bob.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
All right, this quote was
offered up by a listener, Glenn Bach.
Thank you, Glenn. Bach.
Appreciate it. good one, Bach.
You remember that?
I do, from MASH.
Holy crap, dude. Very nice.
Thank you.
Radar O'Reilly. Very good, man.
Gosh, MASH. Boy, we used to watch that almost religiously. Well, in any case, back to the quote. Science, above all, respects the power of the human intellect. Science is the apotheosis of the intellect and the consummation of the Renaissance. Science respects more deeply the potential of humanity than religion ever can. And that was written by Peter Atkins in his book, The Limitless Power of Science, which he wrote in 1995. And Peter Atkins, English chemist, fellow at Lincoln College at the University of Oxford, and a writer on such subjects such as the power of science.
Yeah. You know what apotheosis is, Jay?
The apotheosis, isn't that where you go to get things for your apothecary?
So that is the when you basically make something divine.
Highest point.
Like if you treat a man like a god, or if you take a subject and you sanctify it so it's divine, then that's apotheosis.
That's actually one of the two definitions, and Bob's is the other one. I was just looking it up as you guys were talking. So the elevation of someone to divine status, like at the deification, or the highest point in something, like the climax or the
apex, or
you know, the epitome, the apex.
So science is the apotheosis of the intellect, the ultimate expression, I guess, of the intellect.
That's far as we know so far.
Yeah.
Now, who knows what some cool shit we'll discover once we're super augmented intelligence people. I didn't say that right.
That's okay. We got the point.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Anytime you need me.
We'll see everyone at the Friday live stream. And until next week. This is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.